together. It's a beautiful day. You guys got an extra hour of sleep or so, right? Everybody feeling better? So we got all kinds of stuff planned for this morning just to kind of keep you on your toes because, no, we don't. This morning, though, we are looking forward to getting into kind of a new mini-series for the next month or so. We just came off of a great series on relationships and looking at what does it take to really have relationships and build relationships that last with each other. And the reason we want to do that is because God has called us to be a community, to be his people together. And so we need to know how do we build those relationships with each other well so that we can be that community, that larger group of relationships together well alongside of that. And so we have been in that for the last several weeks. This week we're going to start into a book that many of us, you may not even know where this thing is. It's in the Old Testament. It's one of the littler books, you know, the minor prophets. It's called the Book of Hosea. And so this week, if you want some extracurricular kind of homework or something like that, you can go on a scavenger hunt in your Bible and just try and find the Book of Hosea. You know, that could be kind of fun. So we'll be looking at that, and so we're starting this morning in Hosea chapter 1. The reason we're looking at this book is because we're talking about relationships, really. What is that one relationship that we look to be the model? To be, what do we model our relationships on with each other? Well, we model it on how does God relate to us? How does God love us? That's what we want to love others like. How does God approach us and deal with us and all that we are, all of our mess, all of our good, all of our bad. That's what we want to look to as our model. And Hosea, that's what this book is about. So starting in Hosea 1, verse 1 through 9, it says this, "The word of the Lord which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, the king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to him, 'Go take to yourself a wife who will be unfaithful, and take as your own the children that result from her unfaithfulness. For the land commits flagrant unfaithfulness, forsaking the Lord.' So he went and he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, 'Name him Jezreel, for yet in a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And on that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel.' Then she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, 'Name her Lo-Ruhamah. For I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, that I would ever forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah, and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by the bow or the sword or the battle or the horses or the horsemen.' And when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, 'Name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God.'" This morning, we're going to do something a little bit different with our sermon. Usually, you're used to having one person just stand up here and just kind of take the whole thing on. But today, Cheryl and I are going to try something different. We're going to kind of ping-pong back and forth. We're going to share the sermon. And what Cheryl will primarily be doing is she'll be coming up and giving you a little bit of background. Sometimes it's hard to understand what is going on and what God's talking about in the Old Testament. And so she's going to give some of the background that tells about the story and about the setting so that you guys, maybe we can make a little bit more sense about what God is saying through his message in this book of Hosea. So this time I'm going to ask Cheryl to come up and share with us.
Now, if you want to find Hosea, all you do is look for the big books like Ezekiel, Daniel, right, and they're right there. So it's one of those things that you... If you learn that song, remember Jeremiah, there's a song that you can actually remember for all these books. So around 750 BC, we find this little house in a neighborhood that looks just like all the rest of the houses in the northern kingdom of Israel. And it looks like everybody else's house from the outside, very much like the rest of the block. But when you peek inside, you see a typical family, a dad and a mom and three kids, and they look very normal. Except for the fact that the dad just came home from a day at work at the local prophet school of Yahweh. Now, dad is a follower of the one true God, Yahweh, in a kingdom where idols and gods and goddesses are almost in every single home. His name is Hosea, which means salvation, which is fine, except for his kids actually think he's just a weirdo. So, and his wife, well, she basically ignores him because she's off cavorting with others. And by others, I don't mean the local band. This cavorting is what she calls religious activity in the local market where promiscuity is celebrated. Her name is Gomer, not Homer, as she is called, Gomer. So Gomer returns each day with the best sandals and scarves and pottery her overly extended credit can buy. And they are living large. It's a time of prosperity. The nation is doing super well. But when you look around the table, you see these three children. And again, they look pretty normal. The firstborn, though, is named Jezreel. And this comes from sort of a play on words, Jezreel, Israel, but it's actually reminiscent of a tragedy that happened in their nation that deals with bloodshed and ruin. Now, the next child is named Not Loved. Now, this child is a very bitter child, and she sort of has a very striking resemblance to the butcher down the street. Their third child is really their second son, and bears the name Not My Kid, which causes all kinds of whispering around the watering hole during the day.
You know, it's interesting, but as far removed maybe chronologically as the story is from us, it's about 2,200 years ago that this happened, and as far removed as some of the details are from us, things like mud brick houses and strange names for the kids. I mean, can you imagine setting your kids up with names like that? First of all, Gomer, really? You know, but then calling your kid, yeah, and this one's called Not Loved, and this one's called Not Even Mine. I mean, but aside from those kind of details, the truth is that a lot of the details of the story, if we were to look at them, they really could be used to describe maybe some of the normal-looking houses and normal-looking families in our own neighborhoods. Whether that's here in East Greenwich or in Warwick or in North Kingstown, that these are the type of details that may describe many of us, may even describe some of our own homes, some of our own homes growing up, maybe some of the homes even now. And you say, how is that? How do you mean? There's nothing similar between these two, but you think about it. There's this mom and this dad, and there are these three kids, and it's obviously a blended family because it appears that there are three fathers involved. It's also that no one is on the same page spiritually in this household. The mom and the dad are not on the same page as far as relationally. They have all kinds of troubles, and yet financially they seem to be doing just fine. In fact, what Cheryl was saying, that financially this time in northern Israel, everybody was doing well. And so everyone seemed to have their lives put together. It things seemed to be going well and on a good track, and they wanted to stay on that. But in fact, behind the scenes, inside the walls of these homes, things were falling apart. Most of the families around Homer, or Hosea and Gomer, thank you for Homer. Yeah, Hosea and Gomer, they looked a lot like them. The biggest difference in this household was that Hosea was an actual prophet. Now, what that does is that means that while most of these families, with all their chaos and all their mess, they just get to kind of drift off into the obscurity of going into history, right? And nobody's heard about their problems, but here's Hosea, and he writes down this snapshot of their family. And it's a rather dysfunctional snapshot when you look at it. And so we pick it up, and the only reason that we have it thousands of years later is because it gets attached to and becomes a part of this message that God is wanting to speak to his people, both in Hosea's day, but also in our day. And it becomes not just a part of the message, but it becomes almost like a picture, an illustration of the message that God wants to get across to his people. And so we pick up the snapshot and we look at it and we say, what do we see? Well, we see a mess. I mean, it is a mess in that household with those names and those dynamics going on. But in truth, when we look at it closer, we find that it's the kind of mess that maybe we experience or that we see in our own world, the kind of mess that we try and cover up at times in our own lives, the kind of mess that we try to cover up at times in our own families and in our own homes as well. The book starts out with God telling Hosea to go find a wife. Now, some of your Bibles, they imply that Gomer may have been a prostitute, or at the very least that she was very unfaithful and she just slept around a lot. But the truth is that that doesn't really give a clear picture. Probably Gomer was a very faithful worshiper of Baal, either of Baal or of the Asherah or of the golden calf that Israel set up, because part of that worship as a fertility cult, part of that worship was being sexually involved with others who weren't necessarily your spouse. That was part of the worship. Part of that worship then implied that occasionally you'd find yourself bearing a child that was not your own husband's. And so we look at Gomer and we say it seems that she in fact was a very faithful worshiper in her region, because in fact everyone in northern Israel, this is how they worshiped. This was what worship was to them, except for some of those strange ones like Hosea and those others that chose to follow Yahweh in those kind of traditional old ways. But then Hosea was not only called on to commit himself to this unfaithful wife, but he was also called on to commit himself to the care of her children, all of whom were born after they were married, but only one of whom, if you look at the language that's used, only one of whom seems to be his own. And then God says, and I want you to name them, these other two, I want you to name them simply what they are. What they are, and honestly, what other people are probably whispering about them behind their backs. So he names the daughter, he says, this one's called Lo Ruhamah, and that means no compassion. And you say, no compassion, what is that? Because compassion is a word that comes from this, we've talked about this word before, it's this word that it comes from the same word as a woman's womb. The woman who carries this child for 9 months in her own body is the compassion, that love that's compelled from the deepest part of you towards one who is your own. And he says, it's another way of saying, you know, no compassion because this was not my own. And then they have the son, the youngest son, and it says, and this one will be called Lo-Ami, which literally means not my people, but really, it's just another way of saying, this one's not mine either. All of that might sound kind of weird, right? I mean, these are the children of, that verse 2 had said, these are the children of Gomer's unfaithfulness. And all of that with the worship and the unfaithfulness and the strange names, all of that sounds strange, doesn't it? It sounds kind of, in fact, there are parts of it that sound kind of gross, right? To have worship like that going on, it's like, how do these people do that? But before we get all kind of high and mighty and get all morally, you know, above in these northern Israelites of the day and thinking we're better than them, honestly, think of how others from other times and other places, other historical eras, how they might look at maybe some of the ways that we define and describe and act in terms of worship, or in terms of how we define and act in terms of sexuality. Because there are many times and places that people would look at our era and say, you know what, that's just gross. That's just wrong. That's just, I don't know how you guys can put up with that. Because the truth is that the definitions and the practices of religion and of sexuality, and especially how those two have come together at times, has been this constantly shifting sand around us in this world. Every culture chooses to say what's in, what's out, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And the only one who seems to have this unchanging definition of these things seems to be God himself, as the world just constantly changes around him, not just in Hosea's day, but in our day as well. And so God looks at this and he says, you know what? I know that the rest of your community calls Gomer a very faithful woman. In fact, she's so faithful, she actually has brought forth two children as a result of her worship at the temple. But God says, I call that unfaithful. Sometimes we need to ask ourselves the questions, not what does our society call us, not what do even our best friends call us, but what might God be saying about our lives and our activity? Because I think sometimes we look at our lives too and we say, I'm really faithful. I mean, compared to other people, I'm super faithful. But is that really how God sees it? Is that what God would call it? Because even though we may not be dealing with the level of mess that Hosea was, the level of spiritual and cultural and family and sexual and social mess that Hosea was, this world is a messy place. And all of us are dealing with that mess. All of us have it. Our hands, our lives, our families, our homes are full of this mess. So the more important question that we need to ask is not just what would God call us or what might God say about us, but how does God respond to the fact that we have this mess in our lives? It's inevitable. It's almost unavoidable. And does this book have anything to say about it? Because the truth is that when we go around, a lot of times we try and cover this mess up, whether we try and cover it up so that other people don't see it, or more importantly, we try to cover it up so that God doesn't see it. And the reason we do is because we believe that this is what keeps us from God. This is what keeps him from loving us. This is what turns him away from us, is our mess. We believe that when God, sometimes he looks at us, that he is disgusted by what he sees. That he is just personally insulted by what he sees. That he's angered by what he sees. And because of that, he's disgusted and angered and insulted when he sees us. We think that that's what turns him away. But the truth is about that is that if that was his only or his first response to our mess, not a single one of us would have any chance ever of being loved by God. Because we all have it. Amen? We all have it. It covers us. It saturates us. It's the world we live in. It's all around us. It's all around us. It's in us. We all have it. In fact, in Psalm 130, the psalmist wrote, you know, if you were to hold our sins against us, if you were to hold this mess against us, who could stand before you?
So again, we have this dysfunctional family trying to live out their lives. But they're not only sort of living with their own stuff, they're carrying a history with them, stories with them that weigh heavily on their backs. I mean, we're talking about 400, 500, 600 years of history where they started out as a people with 12 tribes under Moses marching towards his promised land. And at this point in the northern kingdom, they've actually separated. 10 of those tribes left the other two tribes, and they created this northern kingdom and this southern kingdom. They are at war with their brothers and sisters, those that they marched out of the Exodus with, those that they spent time in the wilderness, those that they actually conquered the land with, and they just separated. And they miss things. They miss things like going to Jerusalem and worshiping in the temple that Solomon made, where they worshiped the one true God, where his presence was found, and said, one of their new kings said, hey, I don't want you traveling down there. That looks bad on me. So I'm going to create two different capitals, and I'm going to put golden calves in those capitals, because that worked really well for Moses. Not, right? And one of their most famous kings, Ahab, he made this capital in Samaria, and he started trading, and he made these gold and ivory articles that went all over the world. They were making lots of money. The opulence made their other countries jealous. And so he would say, well, we need to go to war with everybody because they're jealous of us. And this opulence came with a cost. Because as they gained more and more wealth, the kings and their sons started to rebel each other. They started assassinating each other. They killed each other off, to the point that that's why Jezreel was named Jezreel, because it is about the Queen Jezebel, which we know thousands of years later her name means because she was cast out over a wall and eaten by dogs because of the war and the stuff that was going on. They ended up mixing all these gods and all these idols into their homes, where almost every home had its own idol. They could do what they want. The sexual practices, each household just decided what they want that made them prosperous or powerful. This is not the Israel that King David had, that King David started when he danced before God. This is not the beautiful vision that the prophets and the psalmist sing about and talk about. This is not the vision that came with the promised covenant of the Most High God, who said, I want to do life with you. Instead, this was a picture of dysfunction, violence, promiscuity, and power that shaped everyone's life.
So from that description, sounds like the 8th century in the northern kingdom of Israel was not the easiest place to try and be a faithful follower of Yahweh. It's not the best place to try and be a faithful prophet of God. And so here's Hosea trying to live out this life that God has called him to, but coming up against not just within his own home, but within his whole culture. Now, I think that some of us might be able to relate to that as well, because I don't know that the 21st century in the United States is exactly the easiest place to be a faithful follower of Jesus as well. Would you agree with that? 21st century America is a tough place to try and faithfully follow Jesus Christ, because like in Hosea's day, in our day, the cultural lean of our society, it seems to lean away from where God is leaning into. Lean away from God's purposes, God's plans. Violence seems to be a tool that anyone can use at any time to gain what they want. Sexual activity seems to be more of a hobby instead of this outgrowth of a commitment that you make to another. And the words that we say, the promises that we make are good as long as they get you what you want, but it seems like we can drop them at any time after they have outlived their usefulness. Like in Hosea's day, and we need to see that Hosea's day was a lot like our day, in that the political machinery of his day was also taking on all this God talk and clothing itself in all this God garb in order to legitimize, in order to justify some very unjust type of decisions. And just like in Hosea's day, in our day, spirituality also seems to be whatever you want to make it. You get to pick things. You get to cobble your spirituality together. Everybody gets to choose whatever they want to do and however they want to live. And they get to say, and this is being faithful. And what's most important is to be faithful to yourself rather than to be faithful to anything outside of yourself, some other kind of a calling. It'd be one thing if this kind of mess were just found in an occasional household around us. It'd be one thing for Hosea if this mess were just found in an occasional household around Israel. But it was everywhere. And it is everywhere. It's around us everywhere. And it has been, and we need to see this, it has been for thousands of years. And the path that actually led to the problems that Hosea and Gomer and his three kids, Jezreel and Lo Ruhama and Lo Ami, their problems, the path that led to those problems had started not just 200, but 2,000 and more years prior to that. When some important people that they didn't even know were making some important decisions that would end up affecting their lives and changing their lives and making their lives tough because of decisions that they had no control over. Decisions like to leave, to split the nation that God had made one out of 12 and to split and take 10 of them up and do their own thing, to leave the temple where God had said, this is where I will dwell, and instead say, you know, that politically, if we're leaving, we need to come up with our own worship structure. We need to come up with our own worship locations. We need to define our own gods. This is what came down and set the stage hundreds of years earlier for what Hosea and Gomer and their children would be wrestling through. And part of what we have to realize is that a big part of the mess that we deal with in our lives was the table that was set long before we ever got there. And we need to know that. We need to know what we're walking into. Now, some of the things that I'm going to give as examples of this, I know that they're not the most popular things either to either say out loud in some cases, or not everybody's going to agree with me on putting these in these kind of categories, but these are the type of decisions that have been made for us that have set the stage for the mess that we often find in our lives. For example, back around 300 AD, the church decided to take the spirituality of the church and to marry it to the power of politics. And they came up with this concept called the Christian Empire. And so what we've inherited is that somehow we can have these things called Christian empires or Christian nations, and somehow everything that they do is okay because God's put his stamp on them because they're more Christian than just the other places around. And so we use violence, and we use deception, and we use all kinds of things that have nothing to do with Christ to accomplish, supposedly, the work of Christ through this Christian nation. And you guys, I want you to know that in 1,700 years, that kind of thinking, that belief has never helped the church to be the people that God called us to be. Never. We have been shaped by the choice of some that they would use deception, they would use violence to cheat people out of their land, to drive them from their homes, and to do it all in the name of Christ. We have been shaped by some official declarations that came from people in very important places in the past that certain peoples and certain races were not even really fully human, so we could treat them as objects, we could treat them as possessions, we could dismiss them, or we could just eliminate them. We have been shaped by the decision to found this nation, in spite of all of our rhetoric, in spite of all of our great ideals, we have founded this nation on violence and revolution. And we wonder sometimes why we see violence in our streets and our cities, and why we see violence in our schools, and we see violence in our lives, and violence in our households. This nation was founded on violent rebellion. And that decision has impacted our lives. We are shaped by a recent social declaration, rather recent, that all sexual activity is free of any moral constraint. We're shaped by a legal declaration around the same time that unborn babies are simply a part of a woman's body to be managed by her according to her wishes. These are decisions and declarations that have shaped our lives and have shaped our social conscience, have shaped our world, and have shaped the mess that we deal with. Because in these things, God was not necessarily consulted. The definitions that he has, that have unswervingly kind of made their way throughout the eons of time as the sands of our kind of our wills and our determinations have shifted around it. God has stayed true, but he wasn't asked about these things. And so instead of creating this better society that we hoped all these things would bring about, instead we've just seen mess piled upon mess, piled upon mess, that we have then inherited. So the question for us is this: what do we do, and what does God do? How does God respond to that mess? Because those are things we didn't even have any voice in whether we would get those things. They just kind of came flooding down that gully and just engulfed our lives and saturated our societies and just formed our world. Then we look at Psalm 130 again and we say, God, man, if you were to hold that sin, that mess against us, man, who would stand? Who could stand? One of the things we find in the book of Hosea is that regularly Hosea is saying, you need to know that God's first word, God's only word, when he deals with our mess, it is not judgment. It is not just about judgment. Because if it was only about judgment, Psalm 130 asks the question, then who would be left standing? And implied, nobody.
Well, there must have been something in the water in the 8th century BC that it was is still washing down among us. Because, again, Hosea, the northern kingdom, as you expand out, you start to notice what was going on around them. As Hosea is prophesizing and writing down what he's hearing from the Lord, Tiglath-Pileser III was making plans to bring the Assyrian army against the northern kingdom and completely obliterate them. And they did this by inventing the battering ram and learning how to create iron into steel. So the weaponry was even ramping up. And across the sea, the Phoenicians, they marched on northern Africa and Carthage and conquered them. And in Greece, the Spartans were beginning to create city-states, flexing their muscles and saying, we want a part of this land. And I don't mean that Spartan race. But then the real Greeks, the other Greeks, the ones that were actually more learned, were writing down the Iliad and the Odyssey, and they added vowels to their alphabet to make it easier for us, which is, that's crazy too, right? But not to be outdone, Rome is creating their own legendary stories of how they started with Romulus and Remus out of two pups. And they're raising up all these ideas of these gods and goddesses who are claiming territory around them. And then we have to the far east, we have the largest Chinese empire come to power, the Zhou Dynasty, gaining power and control over Korea, Japan, and eastern China. And what we get from them, again, lots of ideology, Confucianism, and other ideology, but we get these great statues and paintings that just get pouring out about how great an emperor is and how godlike he is. And then we have in South America, who knew in the 8th century BC South America was even happening with this Olmecs? How many of you guys have ever heard of the Olmecs? Okay, just a couple, because really the only thing we have left is this big-headed statue of power and worship. And then closer back to Israel, we have the Egyptian Empire losing steam as the Kushites come in and say no more building projects, no more pharaohs over them. And in Europe, we get this little budding Iron Age societies beginning to pop up. And again, they're warring with each other. They're trying to tear each other and take territory. And they don't even have a name because they're not even worth mentioning. But all over the world, politically, societal, religiously, they are trying to live out this idea of bringing their own ideas into practice, creating a place apart from God.
So it doesn't matter if you start with Hosea and Gomer's home, and you see the mess there. You pull back into northern Israel and the surrounding, you see the mess there. You pull back even further, you see in the world, this isn't just limited to a home. It's not just limited to a region. It's everywhere in the 8th century. And as we pull back from time and we look over the vast kind of time of the world, we see that it wasn't just limited to the 8th century either. It's all the way into the 21st century here in the United States, and it reaches all the way back as long as human beings have existed. This mess, this brokenness, this sinfulness, this chaos in the world is something that we constantly seem to be stirring up and constantly seems to be passing down to us in different forms. Now, on the one hand, it's kind of comforting to know that I'm not the only crazy person in here, right? Mine is not the only crazy household with chaos going on in it. It seems like not only are all my neighbors probably in the same boat, but I can go back all the way to Hosea and Gomer and find out that they're a mess too, and all of their neighbors. And so there's comfort in that, but it's also kind of unsettling, isn't it? To know that this crazy, this chaos is so pervasive that it's found everywhere at all times. We can't get away from it. It is made up of things that we see clearly, but we can't do anything about. It's made up of things that we don't see clearly because while God says they're wrong, everybody around us says they're okay. It's made up of things that we decide or are decided for us. It's made up of things that we choose or things that we inherit. So this craziness that seeps in and it becomes the basis for, like, when God calls something what it is, we almost get offended, right? It's like, what right do you have? What right do you say, like with, here's Hosea's kids, and to say, that's not mine? It's like, how embarrassing is that? That God would say, that's not mine, or to call, here's Gomer, and she's trying to be faithful by the rules that her culture has set up. They said, if you want to be a part of our society, a part of our culture, a part of our community, if you want to be a part of this community that God's put you in the middle of, you do these things, and she does them, and then God turns around and says, no, that's unfaithfulness. So here we are left with this shame, this embarrassment, and the confusion, and being kind of very disoriented in this world. That's our mess. We're frustrated by it. We're miserable in the midst of it. So the question again is, how does God respond? The most important question we need to know is, what does Hosea's message say about how God responds to this mess that is a part of our lives? I think three things I want you to take home with you today. The first one is this. We need to know that when God sees our mess, he always sees it clearly for what it is. He always sees it. He's not fooled by all our definitions of what we say it is. He sees it clearly for what it is. God recognizes that the sin and the brokenness and the chaos that is in us will always bring us to ruin. So he is never fooled by, he is never fooled into believing that somehow we have finally come up with a better alternative to the one that he came up with. He's never fooled into that. He always sees it clearly. We see the beginning of it. We say, this seems like a good path to take. It's not until later we find out, oh, wow, that was just another dead end. Oh, well, right? Oh, that was another trip off the cliff where hundreds of people's lives are ruined. Sorry about that. It looked good at the beginning. Jesus would later say, he says, you know what? The road is broad. The road is wide that leads to destruction. And there are a lot of people that find themselves on that path. But it's a very narrow path that leads to life. And few are those who find it. But that's the path that God always has said. He's very clear on. He says, I know where your mess is. I see it for what it is. So God's encouragement to us is this. Trust my perspective on these things. Always trust my perspective on these things. And that's hard to do. It's hard to be a faithful follower of God, whether it's in the 8th century BC or the 21st century AD. Trust my perspective on these things. Second thing is that God, in response to our mess, he always calls it for what it is. Whether it's calling unfaithful what our whole culture calls faithful, or whether it's calling, it's just saying, making a situation known. You know, it's interesting because as a parable of sorts, Hosea's marriage to Gomer and these children that they had, it's funny how many times that we'll go into life with God and all of a sudden we'll find something in our life and we'll say, God, why did you let this happen to me? Why did you let this? And it's something that, you know, we kind of brought in with us and stuff, and it's there, and it's this situation. It's like, God, why did you do this? And God says, you know what? That's not mine. I didn't have anything to do with bringing that into our home. That's not mine. That is not of me. It's not something that I brought about. That one's not mine. Because there are many times that we say we're bringing this in through our own creativity, our own, you know, we know better than God, and we bring stuff into our lives, and it messes our lives up. It causes the chaos. And we turn to God, and God says, I'm with you in it. I'm committed to you and to walk with you. That includes all of this that you've brought, but that's not mine. And he's very clear. on calling the mess what it is, calling the mess what it is, calling sin what it is, calling unfaithfulness. That's why he denounces our sin and our mess, because he knows it's going to kill us, and he is calling us beyond that. So one of the things that we need to realize is that God's clarity, it is only because, you know, sometimes we say, well, wow, that's kind of judgy of you, God, to say that, right? It's a little judgy for you to call me unfaithful. We need to know that God's clarity is the only thing that will give us clarity to be able to pursue the life that he's called us to, that he intended us for. God's clarity. We have to hear his voice. So he encourages, keep his word clearly in front of us, no matter how that makes us feel, no matter how that sounds to our ears. Keep God's word, God's clear word, in front of us to guide us. The third and the most important, I think the most important piece of this, is how does God respond to our mess? We need to know that when it comes to our mess, God always calls us out. But when he calls us out, he always calls us out as his beloved ones, as the ones that he loves more dearly than we can imagine. God calls Hosea to take a wife who is unfaithful, to commit himself to her, to love her, to stay with her, be faithful with her. Why does he say that? He says, because that's what I do with you. That's what I'm doing with Israel right now. God says, I want you to commit yourself to the children that she bears out of her unfaithful kind of lifestyle, even though she's called faithful by her friends and companions, but that is unfaithfulness, and those children that come into it, I want you to commit yourself to them and to all that she brings into this marriage. Why? Because that's what I do with you. I commit myself to love you in the midst of all of your mess, all of your brokenness. That's what I do. So through Isaiah, he basically says to each one of us, I know your mess. I know how you got here. I know how messed up your thinking is, and I know how that messed up thinking, I know what it will cost you, and I know what it will cost all those around you. I know these things. I will never call it right, because it isn't. I will never call it my own, because it didn't come from me. But I will always call you my own. I will always call you the one I have chosen. I will always let you know that you're the one that I intended from before the beginning of time to be my chosen one, my beloved one, my faithful one. God encourages us in Hosea, above all else, know who you really are. Know who God has called you to be, who God calls you as. Know who you are. And live into that. That's probably the biggest challenge, is to live into that. You know, a couple weeks ago I said, you know, these things that God says, just do that. Just take this. God has called you his beloved. That he has called you to be his faithful. Just live into that. Because he says that's where life is found. That's where his blessing is found. Amen? Guys, we have the opportunity this morning to share in this meal that Jesus gave us. And it is a picture of this crashing together of our mess and of God's grace. It's a place where Jesus